Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Don Carnegis, and joining me to introduce today's podcast is a man behind the curtain, Dr. Ken Fort, IHMC's director and chairman of the double secret selection committee that selects all the guests who appear on STEM Talk.
Hi, Don. Great to be here.
So our guest today is Megan Roberts, who is a research scientist and the scientific director at Nourish Balance Thrive, which is an online health coaching company that helps people optimize their health and performance. So Megan is best known for her paper in cell metabolism that showed a ketogenic diet extended the longevity and health span of adult mice. She's also a graduate of the University of California, Davis, where she received a bachelor's degree in exercise biology and a master's degree in nutritional biology.
But before we get to today's interview with Megan, we have some housekeeping to take care of. First, we really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk, and we are especially appreciative of all of the wonderful five-star reviews.
The Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing iTunes, Google, Stitcher, and other podcast apps for the wittiest and most lavishly praise-filled reviews to read on STEM Talk. As always, if you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk t-shirt.
Today, our winning review was posted by someone who goes by the moniker, well, we're actually not quite sure what his moniker is, because today's reviewer signed the review with a smiling face emoji and the American flag. So maybe today's reviewer goes by the moniker The Smiling American. At any rate, the review is great and it's titled Eye-Opening. And the review reads, "We live in a time when education is more easily accessible than ever. But what isn't always accessible is quality. Dawn, Ken, and their guests make compelling concepts easy to understand. Truth be told, this podcast has made me want to go back to school in hopes of one day finding my way down to IHMC. I especially admired part two of Dawn's interview of Ken. I've shared this podcast with everyone that will listen, much to my fiance's dismay."
So thank you, Smiling American, and thank you to all of our other STEM Talk listeners who've helped STEM Talk become such a great success.
Okay, and now on to our interview with Megan Roberts.
STEM Talk.
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 Hi, welcome to STEM Talk. I'm your host, Don Carnegis, and joining us today is Megan Roberts. Megan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And also joining us is Ken Ford.
Hello, Don, and hello, Megan.
So, Megan, you grew up in Chico, California, and I understand that you love the outdoors. So what were you like as a kid?
Northern California was a really great place to grow up, and I did love the outdoors. I still do, actually. I'd say that I was a pretty normal kid. I did have a small group of close friends from a young age, and those are still my best friends today. I was also very serious about school, and I don't think my parents really ever had to force me to do my homework.
Sounds like a great child all around. So in addition to a love for the outdoors, you also had a keen interest in science growing up. So where did that interest come from?
Yeah, so in elementary school, I think I loved math more than anything. And then I had some really great science teachers in junior high and high school that sparked my interest in biology and chemistry. And I've loved the sciences ever since.
And I saw in one of your bios that you've taught martial arts to 5-year-olds all the way to 18-year-olds. So how did you get involved in martial arts?
My dad was a black belt years before I was born, and I guess he decided it was a good thing for me to do as well. And so I actually started karate at a very young age, maybe like 5 or 6, and then I quit and I came back a few years later. I'm really glad I did because it's been a really important part of my life.
Yeah. So what led you to attend the University of California, Davis?
Well, they had a strong science and pre-medical program, and it was also close enough to home that I could go home when I wanted and far enough away that it can be inconvenient if I didn't want to go.
So you entered school with the idea of eventually going to medical school, and you thought that majoring in biochemistry would be a good idea. But the last quarter of your freshman year, you decided to switch majors. So why did that happen?
I actually took an introduction to exercise biology. It was a course that was taught in part by Dr. Keith Barr, who I know you've had on the podcast before. Mm-hmm. And I knew I'd have to ultimately take the same pre-med courses regardless, and I love exercise biology, so I decided to switch majors.
You obviously must have liked UC Davis because you sort of stuck around to get a master's degree in nutritional biology. Why did you decide on nutritional biology as the subject for your master's degree?
So I was still planning on going to medical school at the time, and I knew that nutrition education is largely lacking in the medical school curriculums. And I was already interested in the subject of nutrition, so I decided that nutritional biology would be a good fit, and it was.
Fantastic. And I've listened to some interviews that you've done where you talk about how lucky you were to have open-minded professors and also peers who were part of your nutritional biology program and who were very supportive of you. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So I guess there are a lot of examples of this. Even a handful of years ago in 2014, the ketogenic diet wasn't nearly as mainstream as it is now in both a public and academic setting, I think. And so I was very lucky to work in a lab with progressive thinkers willing to explore the benefits of low-carb diets that were very different from what the American Dietetic Association and other governmental bodies recommend for people. And I was also lucky to have a team of interdisciplinary mentors who helped me learn to think critically across disciplines. So for example, Dr. John Ramsey in aging and then Dr. Keith Barr in exercise physiology. In the aging field, you, for example, want to have mTOR lower. Well, in the exercise bio field, you seem to want it higher. And so that sparked my interest in the tissue-specific regulation of particular proteins such as mTOR.
Well, obviously, that decision turned out to be a good one because your master's thesis, the work derived from that, ended up in a very interesting article in Cell Metabolism. And this article's created quite a lot of attention, I'd say. The paper's titled, A Ketogenic Diet Extends Longevity and Health Span in Adult Mice. And this paper's been pretty widely cited and was also mentioned, it must have been mentioned 4 or 5 times already in various STEM Talk episodes. Before we get into the details and discuss your findings, let's talk about the background of the study. I understand that it wasn't so much a keen interest in ketogenic diets that motivated the study, but rather an interest in aging. Is that right? And could you elaborate just a little here?
Sure. Yeah, that is correct. I was interested in aging, as was the lab I worked in with Dr. John Ramsey. So the impetus from the study kind of came from the fact that we know that calorie restriction extends lifespan in multiple animal models and delays age-related pathologies. However, science has yet to determine exact mechanisms by which calorie restriction positively affects aging, and I don't think we'll ever have an exact mechanism. I think that there are many mechanisms by which that's happening. But we do know that calorie restriction induces a shift from carbohydrate to fat metabolism and also an increase in ketone bodies. And so that's where this idea to use low-carb and ketogenic diets came from. And so we sought to answer the question of whether these metabolic changes that come with low-carbohydrate diets contribute to the longevity enhancement seen with calorie restriction.
So, Megan, when you conducted your mouse studies, you used 3 different diets for the mice. Can you describe these diets in a little bit more detail for us?
Sure. So we used 3 diets, like you said. The first was a control diet, which had 18% protein, 65% carbohydrate, and 17% fat. The low-carbohydrate, high-fat diet that was non-ketogenic had 20% protein, 10% carbohydrate, 70% fat. And then the ketogenic diet was 10% protein, about 90% fat, and less than 1% carbohydrate. And all of the diets were semi-purified. So they were made of things that no human would want to eat. So things like lard, casein, soybean oil, maltodextrin, cornstarch, sucrose. It's amazing a mouse can actually live on it. But I suppose when you think about it, it's probably not so different from some of the refined garbage that people in the standard American diet eat.
Yeah, yum. So an important aspect of your study, too, is that the mice were all being fed the same amount of calories every day. Can you explain to listeners the significance of that aspect of the study?
Yes, I'm glad that you asked. So we fed the mice isocaloric diets to mitigate weight gain. I'm sure that many people are aware of the fact that high-fat diets and even ketogenic diets in animal studies fed ad libitum can cause weight gain and metabolic disturbances, but very little is known about what these diets do to animals that are not fed ad libitum. And also, I should note that most of the high-fat diets that are used are also high-carb, which will induce weight gain as well. And when you think about it, people aren't really ad libitum fed either. So we typically enforce some kind of food regulation on ourselves. And so capping the calories for these mice made it more applicable to humans.
It sounds like life on a cruise ship.
As we were talking about.
Before we get to the longevity results, let's talk about the health span results. This is the part that I find particularly interesting. You tested a variety of different markers of physiologic function that are known to decline with age. Can you talk a little bit about what these markers are and how you tested for them?
Sure. So we tested for grip strength, motor and muscle function and coordination, memory and gait. And we also measured things like energy expenditure and glucose and insulin tolerance. And like you said, all of these measurements and markers have been shown to change with age, both in animals and in humans.
So let's talk about the body composition of the mice. How did you measure that?
So we put the mice in an echo MRI machine, and you basically put the mouse into this tube, which they absolutely hate and they try to get out of, and then you pop them into the machine, which measures fat mass and lean mass.
Okay. So I'm also curious how you tested the memory of mice, which led to your findings that the memory of mice on a ketogenic diet were being preserved for longer.
Right. So to test memory, we use something called the novel object recognition test. Mm-hmm. And in a nutshell, each mouse was habituated to the environment, which is just a box, on day one. And then on day two in the morning, two of the same objects were introduced. And we measured the amount of time that the mouse spent exploring each object. Usually it was about the same amount of time. And then on day two in the afternoon, we replaced an old object with a novel object. So there was one novel and one new in the box. And then we measured the time spent exploring each object. For mice with better memory, in this case, the older ketogenic mice, more time was spent exploring the novel object versus the old object.
I like to explore novel objects.
You must be on a ketogenic diet.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to comment, actually. I'm glad you said it, Ken.
Yeah. For our listeners, please explain how one tests for grip strength in mice. Grip strength is a very cool biomarker for humans and mice. Can you talk a little bit about the hanging mouse test?
Sure, absolutely. So for grip strength, there were two kind of ways that we tested. The first was with a push-pull scale with a force gauge. So we attached a bar to one end to which the mouse was supposed to hold on and to as hard as they could. But let's just say we had a little bit of an issue with compliance. And so we ended up doing the test fasted, and then we held food out in front of the mice for some motivation. And then the other way that we tested grip strength, and also this was motor function and coordination as well, but was with the hanging wire test. And that's where a mouse was hanging on the middle of a suspended wire, and they got points for reaching either end of the wire, and then they got points deducted if they fell off the wire.
So the two areas of health span that saw the most dramatic effects with the ketogenic diet when compared to the other diets were memory, which we've been talking about, and the preservation of motor function. So can you talk about that?
Sure. So motor function was determined by the hanging wire test, which I just talked about. Also grip strength, which we just talked about. And then the ring test, which was measured by the amount of times a mouse would rear up onto its hind legs in a large plastic cylinder. And the ketogenic mice performed better in older age than all the other groups for all of the tests of motor function that we did.
In terms of lifespan, the ketogenic diet also performed the best and increased lifespan by almost 14%. And this is pretty significant. Were you and your colleagues surprised by this?
We were actually very surprised. And it was an increase in median lifespan and not maximum lifespan. So that suggested that we were kind of squaring the survival curve, which is what we want. So the median lifespan increased by almost 14%, which is actually comparable to most of the best calorie restriction mimetics that we have.
So when we look at all three diets that you studied, the ketogenic diet came out on top, followed by low carb, and then the high carb diet had the worst performance. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. And I saw in your paper that the mice who were on the low carb diet gained weight. So did that surprise you? And what do you think was behind that?
Yeah, so it did surprise us, given that all of the mice were fed the same amount of calories. And it's possible that the differences in weight actually contributed to the less optimal outcome in the low carbohydrate group. And the reason behind this isn't exactly clear, but we had a few hypotheses of why the low-carbohydrate, high-fat, non-ketogenic diet group gained weight while the others didn't. And our observation suggested that the mice in our study, the different bouts of activity around feeding might have been a major contributor to the differences in body weight. So the structure of the low-carb diet actually allowed the mice to remove the food from the feeder and consume it while they were kind of burrowed in their bedding, whereas the other diets, the keto or the control diet, were crumbly or sticky in nature and required the mice to stand and eat at their feeder for the entire meal. And additional studies in weight-matched mice would be helpful to determine if body weight influenced lifespan and health span in low-carb animals. And one other hypothesis is that the combination of carbohydrates and fat in the lower carb diet, even though it was only a small amount of carbs, created kind of a hormonal milieu that was conducive to weight gain.
They both make Makes sense. What specifically attracted you to the idea of studying the ketogenic diet in mice as an intervention in roughly middle life, mid to late life, as opposed to just habitually feeding the diet throughout their life? You probably had a reason for that. And do you think the results would be different if these approaches were applied at other stages, either a very late stage or a very early stage?
Yeah, so I'll answer your second question first. And I do think that the results would be different. I don't think they would be as favorable in either case. If you fudged it a little bit before or after, I think that would be okay. But if you started feeding very young and mice were still developing, I think that you could run into some troubles there. But one of the main reasons that we started the diets at midlife was just because many of the calorie restriction studies that increase lifespan begin in midlife.
So these were mouse studies in which you found that the ketogenic diet extends the longevity and health span of a specific strain of male mice. So how well do you suppose that the mouse model employed is likely to translate to humans? And also, what do you think we need to consider when using mice to model human responses to fasting and also ketosis?
Right. So it seems to be very hard to get a mouse into nutritional ketosis, meaning there's very little wiggle room for carbohydrate. We also don't know what the optimal level of blood ketones are in either rodents or humans. And what's optimal is likely context dependent and probably not the same for both species as far as health span and lifespan is concerned. And also this pertains to nutrition research in general. But, and I mentioned this before, I don't know many people who eat a diet even remotely similar to what a mouse eats every single day. And I suppose, like we said, there are some foods, very processed foods, that have those constituents in them, but it's not somebody's habitual diet for the most part. And I know that there's a reason that rodent diets are created with the ingredients that they are, but we have to keep in mind that all ketogenic diets aren't really created equal, and we're not always comparing apples to apples. So, for example, you know, you can have a ketogenic diet of meat, vegetables, and whole food plant sources, or you can have one with Crisco, butter, and bacon as well. And as far as the fasting is concerned, we have to remember that something like an overnight fast to a mouse is not an overnight fast to a human. Mice can only go, I think, 2 to 4 days without food, whereas humans can go a lot longer. And then also, mice are nocturnal. And so, you know, we typically feed mice in the daytime when they should be sleeping. And so we may be disrupting their natural circadian rhythm. And we have to keep that into consideration.
If you had more time and more resources, what experiments would you have done to extend your findings that you reported in the cell metabolism paper with an eye toward increasing the possibility of clinical translation to humans? You must have an idea of what you would have liked to have done.
Yeah, so our study only used the C57 Black 6 mice. And given the fact that we do know that there are well-known sex and strain differences in how mice respond to calorie restriction, I would love to have done a similar study, including females and maybe even different strains of mice. At least anecdotally, in humans, there does seem to be some gender differences in how people respond to ketogenic diets. And I think that including female mice in a study would be really important.
And your study suggests that the metabolic changes that accompany carbohydrate restriction might indeed help increase lifespan, but there seems to be something going on with ketone bodies, so acetoacetate and beta-hydroxybutyrate, that might be playing a key role in the extension of health span. Is that fair to say, do you think?
Yes, absolutely. We know that ketone bodies are powerful signaling molecules, and I don't think that we can discount that in this.
Of particular interest to me, you observed a significant preservation of muscle mass with aging in your mice that consumed a ketogenic diet. There are probably multiple causes for that, but most intriguingly, you reported that the ketogenic diet increased protein acetylation levels and regulated mTORC1 signaling in a tissue-dependent manner. This is pretty interesting. In skeletal muscle, the diet actually increased mTOR signaling, while in the liver, you seem to find that mTOR signaling was inhibited by the diet. So as was noted in the paper, there seems to be a lack of sufficient understanding of the trade-off between the pro-longevity aspect of decreasing mTOR signal and the anti-sarcopenia benefits of increasing it, at least in a pulsatile fashion. I think this is going to be a very important topic going forward. Would you please discuss your findings with respect to a tissue-dependent mTOR signaling and its potential implications as you see it?
Sure. So as you said, mTORC1 is implicated in aging, but it's yet to be determined how it acts in a tissue-specific manner during both aging and anti-aging interventions, including dietary changes. And so we found evidence to suggest that mTORC signaling was decreased in the liver of ketogenic fed mice, and it was increased in skeletal muscle. And in theory, this pattern of lower mTOR in the liver, higher in the muscle, would be what you want for healthy aging. And contrary to what some people might believe, complete suppression of mTOR in general is not what we're looking for. And preservation of muscle mass, Ken, like you mentioned, is critical to maintaining physiological function with age. And we also did some mechanistic research to kind of dig deeper into how mTOR was being regulated. And we found that the hyperacetylation of P53 due to beta-hydroxybutyrate was likely increasing the expression of RED1, and then RED1 inhibited mTOR in the liver of the ketogenic mice. And interestingly, this seems to be the mechanism by which metformin works as well.
So I'd love to hear your take on other tissue-specific effects of ketones that you saw in your work. And so just as an example, we know that in the longevity field, they're broadly positive about the activation of FOXO3, which one sees in ketosis as it promotes autophagy. But FOXO3 activation is consistent with catabolic states broadly. And as a consequence, one would think that activation of FOXO3 should be actually detrimental in the case of muscle and trigger muscle protein degradation and wasting. So why might it be that in ketosis we see increased FOXO3 activation, but we also see no concurrent muscle wasting?
I think, again, similar to the mTOR story, FOXO3 could be regulated in some kind of tissue-specific manner, and we may want it higher in liver for autophagy purposes, but not necessarily lower in muscle.
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience.
So, can you shed any light on the effects of the ketogenic diet on insulin sensitivity in your study? So, the low-carbohydrate diet had impaired insulin sensitivity, and the ketogenic diet did not. And what are the arguments on either side for the effect of low-carbohydrate or ketogenic diet on insulin sensitivity? So, for example, people saying that low-carbohydrate or ketogenic diet might actually worsen insulin sensitivity.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if it's necessarily, I guess we have to differentiate between insulin sensitivity and glucose tolerance here, because we know that the ketogenic diet showed impaired glucose tolerance, but this may have been fixed if we had fed the mice on a ketogenic diet some carbohydrates the day before a test. That's what we typically recommend some of our athletes do or our clients do who are eating low carbohydrate if they want to get a true glucose tolerance test accurate result. And there is some talk, like you said, about low carbohydrate and ketogenic diets inducing a physiological, normal physiological, but not pathological impairment of glucose tolerance. But we did see that the ketogenic diet had slightly better insulin sensitivity, and the mice on the low carbohydrate diet may have become a little bit more insulin resistant due to the weight gain that we saw.
Related to insulin sensitivity, you also get increased IGF-1 receptor sensitivity. And that's kind of not surprising given the similarity.
So a somewhat similar paper in design and outcome from Eric Verdon's group was published in the same issue of Cell Metabolism, and that paper reported that a cyclical ketogenic diet, but not a consistent ketogenic diet, improved health span in older mice. However, they didn't observe the lifespan extension. So can you comment on the key differences in study design or even maybe the interpretation between these two studies?
Sure. So one of the similarities that's important, I think, is both studies tried to keep the high-fat and ketogenic diet animals from gaining too much weight over a long period of time, but we did it in different ways. So we clamped calories well. John Newman and Eric Verdon's group used a cyclical ketogenic diet with a control diet, ad libitum fed, though. And this cyclical ketogenic diet may have been counterproductive stress in older animals where maintaining muscle is really important. Newman's group also used plant-based fat sources where we use more lard, and they also conducted health span testing on the cyclical ketogenic diet group while they were off of the ketogenic diet. And this suggested that there may have been some lasting benefit of ketone body signaling even when the mice were eating carbohydrates. They showed an improvement in memory, like our study, but not motor function, which was unlike our study. And this may have been, again, due to the negative effects of weight cycling.
So what are your thoughts on the enrichment of a standard diet with exogenous ketones, assuming calorie balance and there's no weight gain? Could there be health span benefits analogous to the recent mouse ketogenic diet studies?
So I would like to see more research on this. I think there is little to none right now. And assuming calorie balance and no weight gain, I could see some benefits in certain populations. However, the ketones could still exert their ketone signaling properties, but they may not have as much of the metabolic advantage if glucose was simultaneously high.
Absolutely. A recent paper by Poff suggested that a ketone ester can help prevent some of the negative effects of overreaching, used to be called overtraining, perhaps by stimulating appetite to maintain adequate caloric intake. Previous data has also suggested that exogenous ketones may assist in replenishment of glycogen. So, given all this, how might one balance the appetite-suppressing effects of the diet with the appetite-stimulating effects of an exogenous ketone, either a salt or a ketone ester?
I think it's definitely context and population dependent, but if we're talking about an athlete who needs to get that energy in, but also could benefit from some of the metabolic adaptations of a ketogenic diet, then the appetite stimulating effect of the ester may be a useful way to make sure that they don't end up in a state of negative energy availability, which would ultimately impact performance. But I also don't think that the exogenous ketones need to be used all the time, and to use them strategically, even in an athletic setting, is ideal.
Yeah, I concur. And following up on this, do you think exogenous ketones, in fact, might have their most important effects or among their most important effects? Because as you said, it really is massively context dependent. This whole discussion really is, but one can imagine that for many athletes and perhaps for elite warfighters, one of the most important effects of exogenous ketones would be when they're taking post-exercise rather than only pre-exercise. Most people I know take them pre-exercise and none post-exercise, and it would seem to me that that might be missing some of the benefit.
Yes, I completely agree. And the post-exercise benefits could be through helping with glycogen replenishment and overall recovery, and I think also exerting anti-inflammatory effects. And that's assuming that that they don't impair the inflammatory response that is needed for exercise adaptation.
Yeah, it seems kind of unclear and complicated.
Yeah.
You know, it's really still early days.
So, Megan, are there any other untapped uses of endogenous or exogenous ketosis that you think people aren't considering?
I think there are, and I think that we'll definitely learn more about them in the future. And more applications will pop up. But a couple of things that I am kind of excited about are the fact that there's evidence about using ketogenic diets for some neurological and psychological conditions, such as migraines and also psychiatric conditions like schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. And exogenous ketones also may be beneficial for people with Alzheimer's who, for some reason, cannot adhere to a ketogenic diet, but would still benefit from circulating ketones in their system.
So, Megan, we're going to switch directions just a little bit. What are your thoughts on the communication and interpretation of science of this nature in the public domain? So, for example, we see absolutely ridiculous headlines and quotations of researchers that seem to just be clickbait. So what responsibilities do you feel that university press offices and also the researchers themselves have in this process?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I'm quite actually appalled about some of the headlines that we see in the news that totally take study results out of context. And that definitely happened with ours when it came out. I think that the university press and researchers usually do their best to provide solid information that's good and accurate. But in general, the general press will take what they want and maybe even add some and leave the rest. So it's definitely cherry picking on their part. And there's not, I don't know if there's too much that we can do about it other than not talk to them, but then we risk the public not gaining access to our research. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. And I don't know if there's like a really good answer to the question.
Yeah,
it's become increasingly problematic as journalists look for zippy, clickbait kinds of quotes from the scientists. And it's one thing to have your university public relations people overhype a result. It's another thing when the scientist does it themselves. And that's, you know, recently we saw quotes that eating meat was as bad as smoking. I don't know if you saw that.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, at least 1,000 people probably emailed me about that. And it's ridiculous on so many levels. And yet there it was. And I thought it must have been the PR department, but it wasn't. It was an actual quote from a researcher. It really surprised me.
It's a responsibility, but like you said, at some point, even if you're doing the best job you can, then it gets, you know, misinterpreted or extrapolated in a frustrating way. So,
yeah.
So you've taken over as Chief Scientific Officer at Nourish Balance Thrive from Tommy Wood, who we interviewed in episodes 47 and 48. So I understand that you thought about going to both graduate school and medical school, but knowing both academic and medical systems, you have so far chosen to stay out in the wild working with the athletes, which I agree with. So what is it that made you decide on your current career, and what do you see as your future path?
I will say that I have zero regrets about my decision to stay out in the wild for the time being. And I actually had planned on going to medical school since, I think, sixth or seventh grade. And I made it all the way through the application and the interview process before realizing that my heart wasn't 100% in it. And that's a big undertaking to do if you're not 100%. And I was also far more passionate about the work that I was doing with Nourish Balance Thrive, helping people achieve their own version of optimal health and performance, and also using my background in physiology and exercise and nutrition science to help translate that science into something that was understandable for our clients. I'm really passionate about that. And I don't necessarily know what the future will bring, but I do miss answering questions in a research setting. I think that's one way to get the questions that you want answered is to do the research yourself, which is what a lot of what you guys are doing here at IHMC. Although, as you know, doing the research usually just creates more questions, which I suppose is good job security ultimately. But research aside, I do get a lot of fulfillment helping people achieve health and performance. And the fact that I get to actually foster long-term relationships with our clients and MBT is an invaluable thing and something that I wouldn't get to do much of likely in the medical field.
Yeah, it has to be very rewarding what you do. And like you said, a lot of what we do here at IHMC. So at Nourish Balance Thrive, you work with our friends Christopher Kelly, Tommy Wood, as mentioned, and other colleagues. Can you give us an overview of what specifically you do as a health coach?
So in a nutshell, I partner with our clients and help them achieve their own version of optimal health and performance, whether that's exercise performance or another type of performance. So we do a lot of advanced biochemical testing and then also health coaching on the topics of nutrition, sleep, stress, movement, all those things.
So you spend the majority of your time coaching athletes and clients with chronic health issues. And health coaching has become a pretty popular thing in more holistic medical practices, and health coach training courses are becoming increasingly popular. However, it seems like the general public, despite having a high burden of lifestyle-related disease, aren't necessarily queuing up to be coached just yet. Is health coaching something that everybody needs but no one wants? And if so, how do you think we should fix that?
So I don't think that everybody needs it, but I think that many people in the general population could benefit from a health coach, even if just for a short period of time to get them on track, because we know that education isn't enough. It's action that needs to be taken. And some people are in different stages of the stages of change. So the question is, how do we get people to want what they desperately need but don't want is a million-dollar question for somebody that's much smarter than I think. But one thing I do think would help is ensuring the environment is free of condemnation and judgment with the coach and client relationship. And then if people could see that they wouldn't be blamed for their ailments and that health coaches just want to help them get better and meet them where they currently stand rather than push their own agenda on them, I think that that would go a long way.
Megan, as everyone knows, research into the gut and microbiome has absolutely exploded in recent years. And for interested listeners, I recommend episode number 20, where we interviewed Alessio Fasano on this very topic. Back when we interviewed Tommy Wood in episodes number 47 and 48, we discussed how genetic polymorphisms and the gut microbiota didn't seem to play much of a role in the coaching process at Nourish Balance Thrive because their effect on a person's phenotype was sort of loose and poorly described. More recently, I've listened to some podcasts where you've talked about recovering your own gut health. What have you learned, and how did you go about recovering your gut health?
So I did end up removing certain foods that were major triggers for some gut symptoms. In particular, those were gluten and dairy. And in hindsight, one of the biggest things that I learned was that stress of any type was a huge trigger for me. And that includes even good stress and bad stress. So during the time that I was doing my pre-med studies, that was certainly a stressor. And even something like exercise, which we know increases intestinal permeability, was also a stressor. And it's something that I learned was that you don't want to cram your gut full of a lot of food in and around exercise because of that intestinal permeability that's going on.
Yeah. Have you played with microbiome and the ketone, exogenous ketones?
No.
Yeah, that would be an interesting thing to look at.
It would.
Because, you know, you would expect the butyrate to affect a whole class in the a whole category in the microbiome. Yeah, someone should look at that.
Yeah, and if it's on top of a high-carb diet or if it's on top of an already ketogenic diet.
It'd be totally different, yeah. By the way, did you ever check, when you were having the stress issue, did you check out your heart rate variability?
I was measuring it for a time. It's usually pretty good.
Because that's interesting and
it's sort high of, between.
It, and it doesn't sort of match people's self-reported sense of the impact of stress on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you check their HRV and they're not well aligned often. You know, often it's like, wow, this guy's HRV is 150.
Yeah.
And he tells me, you know, he's stressed out of his mind. Maybe he has a lot of stress in his life, but just copes.
Right. Yeah. No, it's all about perception of stress versus anything else.
Yeah.
So, Megan, I'm just going to guess Nourish, Balance, Thrive must be a good fit for you because I understand that you have always been a fitness and nutrition enthusiast, but I also understand that you have kind of a black and white type A personality that can get you into trouble sometimes as a fitness enthusiast. So is that right? And why is that?
Absolutely. And I do sense another follow-up question on that, so I won't elaborate too much. But and I see this in myself and with other people. Extremism on either the exercise or the nutrition front can definitely get people into trouble.
Yeah, that's a good summary. So at Nourish Balance Thrive, you do quite a bit of writing as well, and you recently had an article titled Why Your Diet Isn't Working, Undereating and Overtraining. Can you talk about that?
So for many of our clients and also myself, people often end up in this state of low energy availability when they're trying to optimize their exercise performance because they're trying to eat a diet rich in either whole foods, which is what people should be eating, but it's very easy to undereat on a diet of whole foods, or even worse, like a low carbohydrate whole foods diet, which is very nutrient dense and healthy. But at the same time, you know, it takes a lot of sweet potato or a lot of broccoli or a lot of steak to make up those calories that you need. And when people aren't eating enough and they find themselves in that state of low energy availability, you know, hormone levels tank, they don't see the performance or body composition benefits that they're looking for, and they end up blaming it often on something other than eating enough. And so a lot of my own time is spent convincing people to eat more food.
Right.
Hmm. With your clients, have you done a deep dive? Let's just take the males because it's somewhat simpler. Have you taken a deep dive into their hormonal health?
Yeah.
And correlated it with performance at all?
Because
it's tricky, you know?
It's not always correlated with performance.
No.
Sometimes I see pretty low testosterone numbers.
Yeah.
And they're performing fine.
Yeah.
Now, could they be performing better? I don't know.
It's super tricky.
Yeah. And then we see like really high SHBGs in a lot of people as
well.
And
that's not well understood either.
Mm-mm.
Those go up with age. And so those people end up with less free testosterone.
Yeah.
But the role of SHBGs is just now being understood. And when I was a young scientist, we thought they were the bad guy, right? And now we think that they play an important transportation function, like a chaperone kind of, and are key to moving the testosterone to where it needs to go.
Oh, interesting.
And the goal used to be, let's get rid of those guys. So anyway, I find it all very complicated and interesting.
Yeah, and it tends to also, like, it decreases with insulin resistance and increases with insulin sensitivity. So that's another kind of paradoxical thing.
Yeah, and then the whole thing is really interesting and highly personal.
Yes.
You know, some people normal is 400, and they're fine.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I was 400, I would be in the hospital crying, you know, begging the doctor.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's everyone's different.
Right. And also, like, the testing is great, but it also can come back to bite us in the butt because somebody who feels fine will have a testosterone of 400 and then they're like, oh my gosh, I'm not fine. And so it gets into their head.
Even worse.
Yeah.
You have symptoms. I know a guy he talked to me about it and said, you're older than me. How do you feel? I said, great. And he said, what's your testosterone? I said, 1,200. And he said, 1,200? He said, it was the opposite problem. He said, I went to the doctor and mine is 250. And he's an older guy. I said, the doctor should write you a prescription, right? And I said, don't be ashamed. When my day comes, I'll do it. And the guy said, oh, I asked him. And he said, no, that I was normal.
Oh, dear.
you know.
And he was having symptoms.
Obvious symptoms. So he wasn't treating the human, he was treating the numbers. And these numbers are an average, including Homer Simpson, obese old sick guys, right? This is a norm. This isn't optimal. He needs a new physician.
Yeah, he absolutely
That was
does.
My last piece of advice.
Good piece of advice to leave him with.
Yeah. All right. Didn't mean to go down that rabbit
trail. That's okay.
I should mention right here that Nourish, Balance, Thrive produces a really excellent podcast as well.
I agree.
In terms of recent projects, Megan, you've been working with Tommy to develop a blood chemistry calculator that uses machine learning. I'm sure Christopher had something to do with that. To predict things that are going on biochemically in people based on a simple blood chemistry test. Can you tell us a little bit about that and where you see that heading?
Sure. So Chris, Tommy, and then another Dr. Brian Walsh and I have created what we call the blood chemistry calculator. And like you said, it uses a simple set of input markers, which includes a CBC, a CMP, a lipid panel, and an iron panel. And it uses machine learning to predict some issues that may be going on under the hood, such as nutrient deficiencies, toxic exposures, hormonal imbalances, gut infections. And then we also have like different scores that we've created. So there's an oxidative balance score, there's a nutrition score, a toxicity score, a wellness score. And we also, along with the different scores that we have that are based off of both the input markers and the predictions, we also have optimal reference ranges. And those are important because typically how a reference range is created is a given lab creates their own reference range based on a bell curve and then two standard deviations on either side of that. And it's problematic because that's an average for the population, whereas they're not necessarily looking at health outcomes. So what we've done is we've looked at health outcomes and specifically all-cause mortality to generate optimal reference ranges for the input markers. We made this tool to use because we wanted it. And so we're hoping that other physicians and healthcare practitioners will also feel the same way.
So Meg, I'm curious, what does your diet and exercise regimen look like today?
So lots of lifting of heavy things. Mm-hmm. I'm really passionate about lifting weights right now. Hiking in the mountains, mountain biking. That's kind of encompasses everything.
And that sounds like mine.
And your and your diet is clean eating and
It's I don't really adhere to any kind of macronutrient profile. I definitely have done keto before, but right now it's just kind of whole foods, plants and animals, nutrient dense, which is what I typically recommend people start with. And then, you know, we can micromanage as needed where, you know, macronutrients come in and specific food intolerances and whatnot.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, it does sound like your exercise regimen, Ken.
Yeah. Weights, the
outside.
Forest,
yep.
Bicycle, hike.
Yep, absolutely. That's a great way to go. So somebody present when you first met Tommy Wood tells us that your first conversation was about why eating like a sumo wrestler was the best way to gain weight. So can you tell us about that conversation?
Yes, actually. I asked this question when I first met Tommy because I was in a state where I needed to gain some weight. And we know that the worst way to gain weight is to eat a standard Western diet with plenty of processed and refined carbohydrates and fat. And this kind of diet can cause metabolic derangements such as insulin resistance by increasing gut permeability, by increasing inflammation, also endotoxemia, and also negatively shifting the gut microbiota. And so if you wanted to gain weight in a healthy manner using overfeeding interventions that don't exacerbate endotoxemia, which increase inflammation both systemically and locally in the gut, what you want to do is eat like a sumo wrestler. So eating a high carbohydrate diet, but also exercising so that they can stay metabolically healthy because they will gain fat that's largely subcutaneous rather than visceral, largely in part to the fact that they are avoiding excessive endotoxemia due to the combination of carbohydrates and fats, and then the detrimental metabolic side effects that come with it.
Sounds like a fascinating first conversation to have.
It was. Yeah. All conversations with Tommy are fascinating, but that one was particularly good.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Well, Megan, it's been fantastic having you on STEM Talk. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Great. It was a lot of fun, Megan.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
Wow, so what an interesting story Megan has. And I think it's fascinating that her college thesis ended up in cell metabolism and has generated so much attention. And I also think that the health coaching that she and Tommy and the others at Nourish Balance Thrive are doing is fascinating work.
Indeed, she was a really interesting guest, and I look forward to seeing how her findings on the ketogenic diet as it relates to longevity and health span translate to humans. But all in all, a very interesting guest, and we appreciate her coming on STEM Talk.
Absolutely. If you enjoyed this interview as much as Ken and I did, we invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage where you can find the show notes for this and other episodes, stemtalk.us. This is Dawn Carnegie signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until we meet again on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others. So please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.